Well, hello, film sackers. Just so you all know, this is a little bit different today. Why? Because, well, first of all, we're releasing a show in the middle of the week. And second of all, it's not a regular show. It's me interviewing a couple of film people. I'm going to start doing this a whole bunch more on the show, I hope. And very excited to talk to John Abel, or Abel. I'm still not totally sure how to say his last name. We didn't clarify that in the interview. And Glenn Berger. That's right. John and Glenn. John Glenn. Get it? Anyway, they are the writers behind Kung Fu Panda and many, many, many other movies and TV shows and other things. And we talk in depth about all of that. So hop in and enjoy today's weird interview edition of Film Sack. Hello, everybody. As promised, I have a quick interview with a couple of guys I'm very excited for you to meet. They are John Abel. Am I saying that right, John?
You are saying it 100% correct.
Okay, good. That I can throw people off. I wanted to make sure I didn't mess
that
up.
John. John, you had excellent.
All right, good. And Glenn Berger. No, not John Glenn. We don't have him on the line, but we have two guys that are responsible for a lot of creativity in the Johnson house here. My kids absolutely love their films, and they are the writing team behind today's most popular, beloved films. I could name a few. How about Kung Fu Panda movies, including the new one, which we'll talk about here a bit. Monsters vs. Aliens. They've got the new musical Trolls coming soon. That comes out this November with Justin Timberlake and Anna Kendrick. Some of their other stuff you may be familiar with, the SpongeBob SquarePants movie and the recent sequel, Sponge Out of Water. Another favorite around here. And in addition to their film work, they are known for 6 seasons of writing for King of the Hill and getting an Emmy for their work over there. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And I really want to thank you for stopping on that filmography just before you got to the embarrassing entries. you stopped it.
We won't name those, though.
No, you don't want to name those by name.
But go to IMDb and delve a little deeper to see where we get embarrassed.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because before we get too deep into what's going on these days, I'm very curious, as a huge fan of King of the Hill and a show that continues to be sort of comfort food for me even today, what was that like in terms of its, I guess, was that preparation time for doing big budget, huge Hollywood family movies? How do you see that time? Do you look back on it? Are you glad you sort of had that time in the trenches with those guys?
That's something John and I sometimes volunteer, but no one's ever asked that question. That's a great question. And in a strange way, doing 6 seasons on a animated TV show was the best possible. We call that our film school, because that show was no laugh track. It was 3-act structure. We had the real gift of learning our trade under Mike Judge and Greg Daniels. And Greg was just obsessive about letting the characters tell a story, not just going for a joke for its own sake, but always in service of a greater story, not being afraid of slow emotional moments, all these things that we brought to bear on our movie career. In fact, when our time at King of the Hill was up and we had the kind of stereotypical couple of years of a development deal where we wrote pilots that never got made, we found ourselves less equipped to write TV, primetime sitcom-y kind of stuff than we were film work. And we kind of made that key career decision to segue into our film careers. And we've never looked back.
Do you see any future projects that, well, this is probably talking way ahead. I know you've got a lot on your plates now, but does TV ever hold a place for you guys again, maybe down the road?
Strangely enough, someone unearthed one of the pilots that never got made from, what year? How old was that, John? Maybe 10 years ago?
10 years.
So this year, one of the studios that owned it unearthed it and asked us if we'd come back and redo it. And it's a happy problem, but we're just too busy in the movie world to go back. But yes, someday that is definitely something we'd love to do, especially since ever since we left television, that medium has become crazy successful and some of the best writing and entertainment. Well, it's not because we left it that it got right. So great, but yeah, we definitely love to go back someday.
Well, King of the Hill is one of those early examples of animation working, but not just working as a medium, working with stories that are not necessarily for kids. And there was a perception for a long time that animation is for kids. So if we jump to today and the work you're doing now, Kung Fu Panda series seems like the perfect place to ask this question. That's a series of movies that I took my kids to and they loved and I loved. I wasn't sure how it was that we were both enjoying the same film. In other words, you guys have this grand challenge of writing a film for a family that includes little kids, medium-aged kids, teenagers, maybe some adults. And you've got to make it sort of entertaining from a writing perspective for all of those demographics. How challenging is that? to do in a feature film like this?
Well, it's always the hardest thing to make something that's entertaining for, I guess they would, you would say these days, four quadrants, for male, female, young, and, well, no one says old, so we say slightly older than young. But I think what we found is that kids in general will enjoy and sit through most movies. And it's the adults who are the hardest to keep entertained and to give them a story that where they feel that they enjoyed seeing it in addition to just having gone because their kids wanted to see it. Mm-hmm. And in the end, I think everyone making these movies, we make them for ourselves, meaning we want to make sure we entertain ourselves. And we never say, well, I don't find that funny and I don't enjoy that, but hopefully a kid will. So we try to avoid any sort of pandering to an audience of saying, well, this one is for them and this one is for us. And I think in that way, as long as we are telling stories that are rich enough to keep our interest, that the audience will be there as well.
Well, I did a little homework. You guys are my age by about a month is all. We're different in age. And I sometimes feel like there's something about our generation that trapped our childhood and kept it from leaving. And we're unable to sort of grow up. I wonder what inspired you guys as kids when you were growing up. What was, you know, what were the animated or otherwise? What were the things in either comedy or animation that inspired you guys to go on to do what you're doing?
Well, for me, it was. I mean, very fortunate that I had a father who made us take naps during the day so we could stay up and watch Saturday Night Live and then SCTV, which was on after SNL in America back then. And I have distinct memories of the first season of Saturday Night Live, which came out in 74, 75. So I was 5 or 6 years old. My dad was making me stay up late enough to watch those shows, which is kind of crazy. Now as a parent of 3 kids, I can't imagine letting my 6-year-old stay up till 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. to see a Canadian comedy. But, I owe a lot to him for that. And I'd say Monty Python also, which back then was only available on our local PBS station. I think those are my big three.
And Woody Allen, the early comedies.
Yes.
Let's see, Animal House.
Yeah.
And
haven't seen. It's now a point of pride. I still have not seen Animal House.
And probably Marx Brothers movies.
Yeah. That's interesting. It seems like the... I don't know, the lineage of comedy writers in this generation that are around our age, they seem to have found inspiration in places that may even seem, I don't know, like their grandparents' entertainment. I remember thinking, you know, the Mary Tyler Moore Show was funny, and I had no business watching that, but I remember thinking it was really funny. And all the interviews I've done with various creatives and writers like yourselves, they all seem to find inspiration in a lot of stuff that maybe wasn't even designed for them. And I wonder how many kids are, to kind of circle back to the other question, how many kids are watching a Kung Fu Panda movie and in 20 years will look back on it and go, I didn't realize it then, but I loved this thing that was really written for my parents and it informed the way I write and so on. Do you guys hope that...
That will both be very cool and make us feel very, very old. I will say that I may not make my kids stay up till 2 a.m, but I'm very, very proud that they love shows like Blackadder. They have really, really good taste. Even now, like, they'll watch repeats of Malcolm in the Middle or Raymond. As opposed to some newer things that are less good, and certainly they watch new things. But I'm very, very pleased with their taste in comedy these days.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to see them reaching back into things that aren't necessarily what's being forced at them by, you know, the powers that be in the current age. And I think that's a pretty good thing. Netflix is probably better for them than we thought. So,
it's funny. I was just gonna credit Netflix. There's something about the curation of shows that have stood the test of time. Like, it's really only on Netflix if it's one of those shows that made it 7 to 10 seasons and it's just beloved. And so, you know, we grew up in an era where, all right, whatever new show is going to be on between Friends and Seinfeld, we'll give that a shot. And, you know, more often than not, that was a forgettable show that just disappeared. Whereas the kids today, they don't have to watch anything that hasn't already been deemed by culture as a massive success, which is kind of neat.
Yeah. I'd never thought of it that way.
We're not wasting time by wasting time.
A lot of parents worried that it was too much and that it was going to just, you know, just destroy their senses to have all this choice. And what it really has done is I think it's refined their choices a little bit and given them a chance to find the good stuff. The Kung Fu Panda movies have always been very star-packed. And that's been since the first one, certainly the sequel, and now this one. loads and loads of what people would call big Hollywood stars. How much of that do you have to take into account when you write for these characters? Is it just a matter of, here's our characters, here's how we wrote it, so Jack Black, Angelina Jolie, Jackie Chan, you guys just need to read these and be these characters, or do they help sort of inform how you write them for the sequel?
No, we definitely will say to Dustin Hoffman, we wrote these lines, just read them as written, sir. And he does. No, it's an incredible thing to say, we're writing these lines and we know that someone like Dustin Hoffman will end up reading them and put the same thought and care and passion into this character who happens to be animated as he put into Tootsie, for instance. Mm. So it forces you to never write anything where you're saying, well, the reason you're going to say this is just because it's funny. Right. You always have to be thinking of the character. And it ends up becoming a collaboration, not in the sense of us all in the room talking about it, but you'll write a scene and the actor will record it and Jack will do this and he'll do a take in which he records the words as written. And then he'll do a few takes where he puts them in his own words and tries to find the meaning in his own way of saying it. And then you go back and forth, you listen to it, you review it in the storyboards, and that informs the next scene you write for the characters, because it is written out of order in many ways. You'll do an ending scene before you do a beginning scene. So you, with Bryan Cranston, there's a very emotional scene where he argues with Poe on the bridge. And we probably recorded that scene before we recorded some of the earlier scenes where the two characters were getting along a bit. So when you see those colors in the character and the way Brian's going to play that, then you go back and rewrite some of the other scenes. So it's all kind of a dance of discovering who these characters are together.
Do you guys get dailies in the same sense that traditional movies do, where you're getting voice work, voice samples of, you know, scenes and things, and then making those decisions on the fly like that on a day by day?
We wouldn't call them dailies. Mm. They're more like monthlies, if I may, in that everything takes so long. It's probably a 2.5-year process of animating this movie. So they'll record these scenes, and Jack may record his lines, and then Kate Hudson might come in 2 months later and add her lines, and then eventually you'll see it all put together, and you'll look at the scene and then rewrite it again at that point. So it isn't like at the end of every day you're handed something and say, okay, that's working. It's sort of a gradual process of sensing what's working, what's not working.
When you go sequel to sequel, I'm presuming that gets easier because a lot of the cast is returning and a lot of the same, perhaps, crew, both technical and otherwise, are returning. And so you've got a lot of the same directors and everything. Does that process get easier, or just the fact that you've got Bryan Cranston in now or J.K. Simmons in now, does that slow things down compared to what you're used to? And I'm just thinking from a sequel perspective here. Does it get simpler the more you make?
Yes and no. It's definitely easier in that we really know who these characters are. Certainly after 10 years, it's closer. It's another way, by the way, that what we're doing now is close to what we did in television. You get to know characters over the course of years. You really, really know how to write for Shifu, you know how to write for Poe. That's great. The challenge, though, just like it was in TV, is how do you do something new? How do you let a character grow? How do you not repeat yourself? How do you let the character grow without fundamentally changing the thing that people love about that character is probably one of the hardest challenges, especially when it comes to Poe over the course of three movies. The joy of him in the first movie was the unlikely kung fu warrior. Can his dreams come true? And then at the end of the first movie, they do. So now what do you do? Mm-hmm. That's been the hardest thing to come up with a good, solid answer to that. What can Poe continue to learn and still remain Poe-like? Yeah. So that's the real challenge.
Some of that stuff really sticks with you. I have a small side note to tell you guys about. I have children that when we do ramen nights where we do like a ramen bar, homemade noodles, all this sort of thing. And all of them chant, "We are noodle folk," every time the evening starts. So... So good job on that. Both James Hong's delivery and your writing has created a real meme in our house.
Wait, we do ramen night too.
Oh, that's good.
I mean, homemade tonkatsu broth.
Oh, it's so good. It's the only way to live. All right, here's a question for you from a technical standpoint, and I'm very interested in this, and I know my audience is in particular kind of interested in this. As the years go by, you make your first movie. Later on, you make the second. Now in 2016, we have a third. Plus other movies you've made. not only do you see those stories evolve, but the technology that puts these on screen, the CGI animation technology that just keeps changing and happening, new tools are introduced all the time to these animators. Does that open up story opportunities? For example, are you ever told in a meeting, oh, by the way, there's no limit now on how many terabytes of background scenery we can have, so go crazy and make a giant, you know, whatever scene with 1,000 characters in it because it's all going to be algorithmically generated or something. Like, how much does that play into you guys deciding what your major cruxes are going to be, what your big climaxes are going to be, that kind of stuff?
I would say it factors in absolutely zero to what we're doing. We don't even think about it. And probably intentionally so, that in some ways, if we knew how much work comes after we write the word, it would be paralyzing in the sense that we might watch a screening and say, oh, we have a better line, not knowing that changing that line means an actor's going to have to come in and re-record it, and then an animator is going to have to spend hours and hours reworking the mouth. And if we knew that, I think we would never change anything. So we stay out of that, but also the imagination and the vision that the directors, the animators, the production designers, that they all bring to it is far beyond what we have. So to be able to write something and then see the way they envision it with the backgrounds, with the designs. In the second movie, when we said, oh, the peacock should have an opulent palace, and then you see what an actual opulent palace looks like. It is absolutely amazing. And in fact, we usually don't see what everything is going to look like until the very, very end, if even at the, maybe at the premiere is the first time we saw the entire movie all the way through.
Oh, wow.
Fully lit and looking beautiful.
That's interesting.
So yeah, most of the way the movie is made, the art equivalent of dailies would be black and white drawings, storyboard panels, because that's, as we're writing the script and then it gets boarded by the artist and then the voice actors come in and record it, that's pretty much the working document for the movie. And then one by one, those chunks get sent to the animation department, and that's where the real, you know, the real CG work happens. But that's gotta happen in kind of a parallel process as we continue to refine the rest of the movie. And as you get closer and closer to release date, fewer and fewer parts of the movie can still be changed. And that's usually you decide what scenes are last to go into animation based on what are the most difficult scenes or the scenes that we haven't really nailed.
Well, it sounds
emotionally
a lot,
or comedically.
Sure. It sounds a lot more symbiotic than I expected. I didn't, what you usually hear when you got the technical side and the creative side, compare that maybe to salespeople and IT. And the salespeople promise the world, and the IT people have to somehow make it happen, or programmers or whatever. And this I assumed was a similar situation. I'm sure not everything's always, you know, sprinkles and roses, but that sounds like a pretty efficient system, or at least sounds like both sides understand how important the other side is.
It's definitely iterative circular. Mm. Unlike live action filmmaking, where we'd write a draft, two drafts, three drafts, four drafts, whatever, and then deliver the script, and the day the director starts shooting is the day they really don't want the writer around, because it's the director's movie now, and that's it.
Yeah.
Whereas in animation, very similarity to our TV work, where we produced it all the way through, so we'd see it from concept to script to production and editing and all the post-production stuff. So we have either the privilege or the crushing responsibility to stick with it all the way to the very end, which for control freaks like us is kind of a joy.
How do you guys manage to work emotion into things? So just another tiny side note, my daughter completely lost it when Ogwe the turtle in the first movie passed, for lack of not wanting to spoil it too much for those who never saw it. And it really got her, like really for hours, just really struggled. I could bring it up and she'd tear up again. That seems hard to do in an animated world, but yet there it was. Is that hard, or am I, you know, am I making you guys magical?
I think you're giving us too much credit. The secret ingredient of that is you take a character, you take a character that the audience has grown to love or respect or enjoy, and then you kill him. It only works if you care about that character. The body count of live action movies, where it's just bodies flying and you don't care, proves that you can't just kill a character to get emotion. But if you really have invested in the character's journey, and if you as an audience are as torn as Poe is when a character leaves too soon, then I guess that's, I mean, it's all about caring.
Well,
and that's a combination of writing, but also the performance of the acting, the performance that the animators put into it, the design of the movie, the music, the direction, to make an audience believe that what they're seeing is a story, even though, you know, in animation, you know, this isn't real. These aren't real people, but you have to find a way to pull people in and believe it's real.
I got to say, congratulations on this incredible launch of the new movie. Great week, starting weekend for that thing, and best of luck in future endeavors. Can't wait to see what you guys do next. And thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh my God, thank you. Thank you for that. You did great homework, and we love talking about King of the Hill too.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.